Welcome back to Passive Income Pilots, everyone. Tate Duryea here with Ryan Gibson. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing great. I'm excited to learn about all these ways you can buy your own businesses and you can operate them and for a good profit. And there's an awesome guest today that we're going to talk to about that. Stoked, needless to say.
Stoked as well. You know, I think that this topic, I certainly came away from it with a much better sense of how this works. That's the idea on this show, right? Is to give you some context, show you, okay, give you some ideas and some context so you can feel it out and see if it's something you're interested in pursuing further. I didn't even know that this was a thing. Certainly that a thing that was accessible to the average person before, I don't know, a couple of years ago. And so I was really interested to learn about it. Now, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think this show is about passive income, right? And it's for aviators who are, they want to learn more. They want to broaden their investment horizon and bring a left and right limit to the whole expanding their knowledge. Right. We could sit here and just talk about real estate the entire time, or we could talk about what we do. But what we don't want to do is we don't want to limit the investment professionals, the thoughts and thought leadership on the show. So we're trying to like find amazing guests that can come in and talk about something that we've never even thought of as pilots. And I think Colin nails that today, which is in 2008, he went out and bought a plumbing company and turned it into a multi-million dollar business and sold it. And he had really no experience other than just like the grit and the tenacity to go take it on. And we're going to dive into how he did that. And as a pilot, you might be thinking, okay, well, what if I'm going to be passive? I don't want to buy a business, but maybe your son, your daughter, some of your neighbor, maybe you invest in one. So this is just broadening your landscape of like who actually owns that plumbing company, or who owns that landscaping company, or how do you even go about finding a company to buy? And I think that's what makes this episode really fun, is we go basic level and we dive into all those things in the show with somebody, by the way, who has done it numerous times. And if you live around Seattle, you know these brands, Southwest Plumbing and the guy in the door of the truck that is waving, Guardian Roofing. I mean, these are big name brands that Colin's company, Flint Group, owns and he manages and benefits from them. So a little bit about our guest. He got his MBA from Stanford University, graduate school of business, as well as a BA in economics from Stanford. And while in business school, Colin founded Skylight Capital, which is coveted pool house just off of the Stanford campus, known as his world headquarters, we're laughing here, and his apartment. And he currently serves as the chairman of Flint Group and Guardian Roofing. Colin lives here in Seattle, right near me. And his wife, he's got two young kids. He's a diehard Stanford football fan, Seattle Seahawks, and the Sounders. And good friend of mine. I say we'll lead the show off with a couple of topics, right? As you listen to Colin speak, he's going to really try to make it basic. But you might hear this word, a multiple of EBITDA. So a multiple of EBITDA. And when you might hear this, and as a pilot, you might think, what is that? Well, EBITDA is earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization. That's just a fancy word of saying basically your profit before you pay any taxes, interest, or amortization. So what your net is to the business, but not necessarily your overall profitability, because if you take loans or leverage and things like that on a company, you're going to have to pay those expenses in addition to below the line expenses that EBITDA doesn't include. So
right.
Businesses are valued this way. I kind of give this example on the show where if you buy a business that is producing $1 of EBITDA, you have to ask what the multiple is of that EBITDA to determine what the value of the company is. And so if you have a company that's trading at a 5x EBITDA and you have a $1 of EBITDA, that's a $5 company, very simply put. So we go into that. We dive into a lot of those discussion points on the show.
But and the reason why, you know, you would take EBITDA versus just net profit is because there's a lot of variability, right? The debt might look different, very different from one company to another. That's why real estate, we take NOI, net operating income, that does not take into account debt service, because one person might have a bunch of debt, one person might have not much debt. And so if we compared those apples to apples, you wouldn't be comparing apples to apples, right? It would skew the numbers. And so we strip those things out. That's where EBITDA comes from. I will mention Colin is absolutely hilarious. This show, this episode is anything but clean. So if you're listening to this in the car with kiddos, maybe save this one for one of those commutes when you got some headphones in.
We like to have natural conversations
exactly.
with guests and not bleep out everything. So just, yeah. But no, I think what's interesting too is Colin's been on a lot of shows and he's a pretty popular guy when it comes to the private equity space. what's interesting, I listened to an episode that he was on. He said 95% of plumbing and AC companies have less than $1 million in revenue, and it's a very fragmented market. So if you buy one of those companies, you're not going to have 300% growth like a tech company, but you're also not going to be put out of business of like new technology. And by the way, toilets are recession resistant, right? Like there's, you know, people are still going to go to the bathroom and the toilets are still going to break even when you have a good economy or a bad economy. So we're going to talk into, is there still an opportunity in that space? And is there an opportunity to buy businesses? Because a lot of baby boomers are retiring and they don't have heirs to their business. So where do these opportunities lie? We're going to talk about that on the show. So with that, let's get to the show.
Welcome to Passive Income Pilots, where pilots upgrade their money. This is the definitive source for personal finance and investment tactics for aviators. We interview world-renowned experts and share these lessons with the flying community. So if you're ready for practical knowledge and insights, let's roll.
Colin, thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate you coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So I know that you are in YPO with Ryan. You guys have a good friendship from that. And we appreciate you coming on and talking about buying businesses. Can you?
It's a friendship of proximity. I just want to clarify. We're in the same grade. So you're forced to be friends. Just so you know.
I like that. That's right. Same neighborhood too, right? Sort of.
Yeah, it's sort of stalker-ish. He's like, hey, I'll be in your group and I'll live near you. And then you should come talk to us.
This is going to be a fun episode. I said before the show, Colin, I love your humor. Can you give us a little bit of background? We read your bio in the intro, talked a little bit about what you've done, but yeah, where are you now? And what does the space you play look like?
Yeah, so thanks again for having me on. For the last 17 years, I've basically bought and built small businesses. So I started my career as a low man on the totem pole private equity guy in 2002, went to business school in 2005 back at Stanford, and then in 2007 started my own firm called Skylight, which is a misnomer that it's a firm. It's just me in a CIA safe house with a little shingle that says Skylight. So that's my thing. And the whole idea was to find...
That was your global...
Yeah, global headquarters.
That was your global headquarters.
Yeah, that's right in a pool house. This is still the global headquarters. It's just... I moved from downtown Seattle to like right behind a mall in a nondescript building, not because I'm famous, but because it was closer to my house and the rent was cheaper. So I'm killing it, destroying it. So yeah, for the last 17 years, I started trying to buy small companies and I didn't really set out with any specific goal in mind. And what happened is I bought a plumbing company in Sacramento in March of 2008. And the strategy was pretty simple. It was close to where I was living in San Francisco. The owners were amazing and they were going to keep 20% and help me. And I was, I think, 29 or 30. And so I wanted their support and encouragement. And they had a lot more experience than I did. And then I thought we should buy a plumbing company because everyone, my friend's like, why would you do that? I said, you all say a recession's coming. I'm pretty sure toilets still break in a recession. And they're like, that's the dumbest thesis I've ever heard. I'm like, it's not a thesis. It's just available. And I need to buy a company to make this work. And so I bought it. Great recession hit and we grew 50% over the next 3 years. And that was really the start of now. I mean, it's not all linear, but I think I've probably invested in or bought 17 to 20 companies and have really developed this niche in home services. And that's like plumbing, air conditioning, electrical, now roof, residential roofing, flirted with pest control. It didn't go that well. And the short version is I bought a company in Texas in 2011 that turned into a big group of four companies that grew to 150 million and we sold it in 2016. I got kicked off I got basically ejected out of that company by the New York private equity firm that bought us. So I bought a residential roofing company in Seattle. My wife said, why would you do this? And I said, it's close. The owners are awesome. It's like the same story. I was like, it rains a lot here. I bet roofs leak. And she's like, that is a horrible plan. I'm like, it's going to work. She's like, you're going to lose all our money. I'm like, I probably won't. She's like, really? I'm like, I have no idea. And so we've owned that company for 7 years called Guardian Roofing, and it's grown from 10 million to 30 million. And then in 2019, I raised $30 million to go start a group called the Flink Group, which was basically another version of what I did before. We bought plumbing and air conditioning companies. We bought seven companies in five states, 70 million of revenue. We grew it to 160 million. We had probably 1,000 employees, and we just sold last August to a big private equity firm called General Atlantic. So I'm the executive chairman of the Flink Group, one of the owners of Guardian Roofing, and then I've been involved in some other boards and so forth. And I'm in YPO with Ryan. Two kids, 13, 11, and married 15 years and live by University of Washington.
That's quite a story, especially the Flint part. Colin missed the part that he's from Flint, Michigan, another Michigander. I'm from the Pontiac area originally, Pontiac, Waterford. So really cool to hear another Michigan success story. Colin, what for a pilot listening, right, that's just flying the line and doing the thing and looking for passive income, and maybe they're thinking about being active, can you kind of talk globally about just what, like, there are so many baby boomers retiring now and abandoning these businesses because there's no heirs that want to take them over or whatever. And the kind of the opportunity that's out there right now to sort of either invest in somebody else's business or invest in and buy your own and operate your own business. Can you speak kind of high level to that?
Yeah. So there's one thing I realized when I first started in 2002, and it's changed a little bit. It's been 22 years, but there are so many small businesses out there. So there's big private equity firms, and maybe we could even just is it okay to give like private equity 101 before we talk about it?
Absolutely. That's why we're here. Yeah.
So I think private equity is in the news a lot. Mitt Romney ran and he was part of a private equity firm and he hit the news when he ran for president. And it's got some good elements. It's got sort of some bad reputational elements. But essentially, private equity is like this giant umbrella. And so there's usually five different areas of private equity. So there's hedge funds, which invest in like public market stocks. If you've seen Billions, that's like a hedge fund. My brother worked for the guy who I think Billions was based off of, Steve Cohen, who owns the Mets. That's called SAC. He worked for him for 15 years. So that's hard to get into for someone who isn't a huge university or pension fund or whatever, but they invest in public stocks typically and do a whole host of other things. There's venture capital, which is early stage investing, primarily in tech. The folks who invest in Google and eBay and Airbnb and so forth. High risk, high reward, it's very cyclical. It was really big in the 90s, then bombed out, and then got really big again and bombed out. And it's sort of going through a little comeuppance right now. There's growth equity, which is essentially like buying, you invest in a stable business that's growing really fast that needs money to expand faster. It could be a consumer product company, or think about like when Red Bull was small and they might have taken on $100 million to get distribution all over the world and that person would own 30% of the company. And that now you're getting closer to what I do, which is leverage buyouts, which is generally what people refer to as like private equity, but it's essentially like buying a house. You can buy a house for cash or you can take out a mortgage and buy a house. And oftentimes we take out some version of a mortgage. And if we're going to buy a house for $100, we'll borrow $20 to $80 to buy that company. And that's, so leverage is a synonym for debt. So you use debt and equity, private money from someone to buy a company. And then the fifth element is this thing called private credit or private debt, which is where big firms are loaning. And so instead of going to Bank of America to get, or JP Morgan to get a loan to buy a business, we have to put up your house and pay 6% or 8%. You'll go to a firm that's basically raised hundreds of millions of dollars to loan people money like myself to buy a company, and they'll charge 10 or 12%. There's versions of that. So those are the five things. I think the one you're most interested in maybe, or at least the one I'm most familiar with, is the leverage buyouts. But that's the backdrop of it, just so folks understand, because it gets thrown around and people might.
That's fantastic. That was a really good breakdown of the different subsectors. Yeah. Can you know, when I first heard someone say, one on a partner that I work with said, I'm not as interested in the real estate deals this year. I'm really interested in all these blue collar, high cash flow businesses. And I'm like, huh?
Get in line.
You know,
dude.
It didn't really resonate with me at first because it's not something that I understood. And I didn't realize the tidal wave of these businesses that are sort of hitting the market. Can you speak to, as sort of Ryan alluded to, all of these blue collar businesses, why there are so many on the market? Are there so many on the market, or is that a misnomer? It seems like it's a buyer's market right now, where because we did an episode with Aegis and there's like this big wave of baby boomers retiring and their kids don't want to take over the roofing business. And so it hits the market at an attractive multiple. Is that true or no?
No. Yes and no. And so, and I might totally abash your listeners of how easy this is to go do, but it's interesting.
And that's okay.
That's okay.
Yeah. So what's happened in our space is, or in the blue collar space, just more generally, is when I started in 2008, I bought a plumbing company, a residential plumbing company. And they're different. Residential is go fix Mrs. John's house. Commercial might be go fix a big building or air conditioning, same thing. You have contracts and so forth. I only do residential stuff. So for most listeners, if you own a house, there's plumbing problems, electrical, whatever. That's what we service. When I started, I was the only one who had that I knew of that had bought a plumbing company up through about 2016. And there's a company called ARS, American Residential Services, that owns Rescue Router, and they had done it too. What I didn't know is a bunch of people had tried to do this 5 years before, rolled them up, put a bunch together, and then blew up. So had I known that, maybe I wouldn't have done this, but I was too dumb to know that. So I bought one and figured it out. So what's happened in the last few years is like no one cared about these spaces. There was no synergies. It was pretty hard. Our businesses are inefficient in the sense that you grow 100%, you got to add like 98% more bodies to the company. You know, it's not like software. If you grow 100%, you just add some salespeople and some dev people and quality assurance people. So they're really hard. And they're super fun and I love them, but they're not, you grow, like we're going to grow a roofing company 100% and we're going to add 95% more people. So that's exciting, but you know, it's a lot more bodies. And what happened was a couple things. My group did pretty well. A couple others did pretty well. And we sold for $200 million in 2016. And a couple private equity firms got interested in that and didn't buy that company. They didn't win the bid. So they started buying some companies. On this, they didn't get, so they started their own group. And then my company that I sold for $200 million that I had begged our private equity firm that backed me to not to sell, sold for $750 million 3 years later. And some of that was growth. And some of that was the multiple of EBITDA, multiple of profit went up quite a bit. So they got the both, they got growth and the multiple went up into what people would pay. And then it was like game on. In 2019 is when it sold again. And that's actually when I started Flint. All of a sudden, more and more people, private equity firms in general are like lemmings. I have this amazing idea. I'm like, tell me about it. They're like, residential home services. I'm like, wow, that's amazing. How did you come up with an idea like that? He's like, well, I saw a bunch of people are buying and selling them. I was like, interesting, good original thinking. So like and then on top of that, there was like ton, you know, we had like this massive growth in the economy. And so more and more money was rushing into private equity. And private equity is like any other business. Like it responds directly to the financial incentives put in place for the people managing the money. And their incentives are to basically raise a bunch of money because they get a fee from it, invest it quickly. Hopefully, if it goes well, they get a percentage of the upside of that. And then raise and then show a good track record so you can raise a bigger fund and charge a bigger fee to invest more money to maybe get more upside and raise a bigger fund. And then guess what happened? COVID hit. And a lot of our businesses did pretty well when people are sitting at home. And the government injected a boatload of money in the economy, which they had to put somewhere. So they put it into private equity. So like more and more money drove up more and more. It's like what you saw in housing or real estate or whatever. Like interest rates are low. People could use more and more debt. So there's all these things that went into it. And I would say in 2021, we put a stop to buying plumbing companies for a minute so we could digest what we bought. But also purchase multiples had gone up 100 to 125%, not like 25%. If we paid 6x profit, EBITDA, we call it, but like, not we call it, I hate when people say that. Like something I like to call EBITDA, I'm like, everyone calls it that. For people who don't know, it's this way we measure kind of pseudo profit. If we were paying 6, suddenly people were paying 12 to 14 times. For no other reason. They said there's synergies and they figured out technology and they could do cost savings, but they're full of shit. I think they are. And what was happening is they would push all this EBITDA together and then sell it to, and maybe they buy them for 8x or 10 times and they'd put a lot of it together and then they'd sell it to somebody else for 15 times. And so there was this greater fool theory happening and like someone was getting left holding the bag and it's happening.
Interesting.
Can I just rewind real quick? Cause I know that EBITDA might not be a term that our listeners know. So I just
want to- It's made up.
It's like if your business, it's made up. Actually, Colin coined the phrase.
Technically, everything's made up.
So think of it this way. If you're buying a company and it makes $1 profit and you sell it for 1x EBITDA, that company is $1.
Yep. Right.
That's right.
Yeah. If your company makes $1 a profit, so all the expense, all whatever, $1 a profit, and it trades at 15x EBITDA, you just take that $1 profit, multiply it by 15. Right. And so when Colin's talking about, I'm buying these businesses between 4 and 6x EBITDA, he's basically buying them for a good price. And then all these private equity companies are coming in and paying 10x EBITDA, then 15x EBITDA. And he's basically saying, at what point is someone going to be caught holding the bag, way overpaying for a business that may not have any value to squeeze out of it and who may not have another buyer to squeeze out of it? So
that's
anyway, I just wanted to make sure that
that's right.
EBITDA, you can look at it.
And we can, I can explain it. It's basically like taking the net income of a company, how much it probably really makes, It's earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization. You should Google it. It's essentially a financial tool that people generated so that they could measure what a company would look like if you didn't have debt, or you could structure it different ways. And like KKR, which is a big private equity firm, started using this back in the day. Warren Buffett hates it and thinks it's ridiculous, like you shouldn't use it. It is not equal to profit. It is not. Because if it's earnings before interest, you still have interest if you have debt. So, okay, that goes down. Did you pay taxes? LLCs don't have to pay taxes, but they should send money out to pay taxes for the investors. So like you probably pay those. So that goes down. Depreciation and amortization are not actual cash expenses, but it's a little bit of a misnomer. It can get a little funky. And it's funny because what we're seeing now is when you said it's a buyer's market, it is. But now every Tom, Dick, and Harry who has a home service company is pretty sure they're like, oh, mine's worth a 10 multiplier. And I was like, guys, there's like actually math that goes into this. It involves like your actual profit, your percentage of profit, your growth rate, like a bunch of things. But everyone doesn't care. They just say, oh, I want a 10 or 15. I want a 6. But there's real math that goes into it. I use like a one-page Excel model that works just as good as the 50-tab models. But there's math. You have to do it because you have to buy trucks and you have to do all this stuff. And you have to make sure there's enough cash to pay for all this stuff.
Is that limited to the home services? When you say home services, plumbing, air conditioning, roofing, stuff like that? Or are landscaping businesses sort of a different animal that haven't been exposed to the private equity space? Are there still opportunities out there in different sectors of these sort of high cash flow, blue collar businesses?
So there are still a ton of opportunities out there. I mean, that's one thing that has just been mind blowing is there are so many companies out there. So I don't want to give the impression that there's not still opportunities for folks to buy businesses. I would say that the more astute run, higher profitable, bigger companies are expecting more for their companies when they sell. There's still sort of small businesses that make $300,000 or $500,000 of profit that you can snipe up for less money. It's just riskier. And it's not bad. Guardian Roofing didn't make a ton of money when we bought it. It was a great culture and a great business, but it just takes a little more work and there's less stuff you can do unless you're willing to get involved or know what you're doing, if that makes sense.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. When you were looking at your first business, 2008, buying a plumbing company, okay, toilets are recession resistant. That's great. How did you even find this thing? Where did you even go to, like, where, I guess Google was around, but you know, how do you even find a suitor, someone who's willing to sell?
So it's way better for your listeners now than it was for me. So I had spent 2002 to 2005 building up a broker database. So there are business brokers. So again, there's all kinds of in the financial world or whatever, for people who haven't been exposed. You'll hear about Goldman Sachs or Morgan Stanley's an investment bank and they take companies public and they sell businesses. They do M&A, mergers and acquisitions. They're like the ones selling like Clorox or taking, you know, Clorox for a big thing. Then there's like, you go down and there's like middle market ones. And then there's like Harry, the business broker. He's like, think about real estate brokers, right? There are business brokers all over the country that talk to the gas station owner in South Carolina and this company in Utah that made like racking systems for cans. And like, it's a company. And so like their job is basically to find small businesses and then take them out to market. When I started, it was highly inefficient. There was email lists and conferences and stuff, and I knew how to get in that. What's cool now is there are tons of resources online, like Biz Buy Sell. You have to Google it, I'm not sure. I don't do this very often. I get like 10 a day from just being around forever. So like, I don't go online very much, but like Biz Buy Sell, International Business Brokers Association, Generational Equity. On their websites, they have a gajillion companies. And you can go look. So if you're thinking about doing this, you have to do way less work than I did to at least just see. And you could say, hey, I want to see this car wash, or a car wash is have gotten really expensive too, but like landscaping company in Myrtle Beach. And they'll say, we need an NDA. Okay, you sign a non-disclosure agreement. It says you won't tell anybody about it. And then they'll sometimes send you a book. Sometimes they'll say, we need to see do you have money? When I first started, I just said I did. And if they asked for more information, I would just do this a lot. And then usually they'd give in and send it to me. So, you know, if you have a lot of money, you're welcome to put, I have a lot of money or $1 million or whatever, and I can afford to buy this, or you can just do this and usually you'll get it anyways. The business brokers wouldn't like that, or just exaggerate. And then you get the thing and you can decide if you want to buy the Myrtle Beach landscaping company. But I know a lot of people who just spend a lot of time on those websites, just looking. And that's partly how I started, was just like seeing what might make sense and what resonated with me and what I thought just frankly wouldn't go out of business. Cause I had 110% confidence and 0% skills. So like I was perfectly set up to do well.
Amazing. Like a lot of entrepreneurs in their early stages, you gotta
be like most 29-year-old men.
That's fair.
Like Dunning-Kruger, like all the way.
Just pure idiot.
The peak of Mont, stupid. Yeah. Yep.
So can we talk about due diligence? This is kind of a perfect segue into, okay, you find a business on Facebook Marketplace or Biz Buy Sell. You find the landscaping business in Myrtle Beach and they say, all right, here are the books. You can fly out and see it. What are you looking for? Like, how do you conduct due diligence on this?
Yeah. So I'm not the best at this part because I have a completely different approach because when I started, I was like, oh, we're going to do all this fancy diligence and whatnot. Like when we sold the Flink Group, a bunch of groups spent a lot of money hiring consultants and doing all this stuff and going through our financials, 7-figure plus. And then they got to bid on the company and buy it. For a lot of these companies, like the Myrtle Beach Landscaping Company, you're going to get some information. It might be, it's called a SIM, a confidential information memorandum. Maybe you might just get financials on the one page thing. You might just get their website and some loose financials. When I started, I was like, oh, I got to do all this work and pay lawyers. And there's financial groups that will actually get the financials for you. They're called quality of earnings groups. There's a great guy named Elliot Holland. He has a company called Guardian. We found him on Twitter. He's fantastic. No, he's just a grinder. So you can do all these things, but I would say like, don't do any of it. Don't fly out. Basically, especially nowadays. So you look at the information, you say, this might be interesting, especially if you lived in Seattle. You're like, okay, how about we set up a Zoom call or Teams or something and like we'll meet. And then I basically see how that goes. If it works well with me, then I basically just make an offer. What, you haven't even visited? I know. Hold on. Let's just see if we're in the ballpark. Because I once met an owner in Dallas who had a $3 million company revenue. We had already had a company there. It was in a neat area of Dallas. We thought we could just add it in and be fine. And he's like, I cannot wait to work with you. This is going to be great. I said, I'm excited. This is awesome. He's like 50-year-old plumbing company. And he's okay, cool. So I just need 30 million. And I was like, what? And he's like, 30 million. I said, dude, that's crazy. He's like, all right, 22. I'm like, nope. And he's like, 18. I was like, no way. And he's like, 12. I was like, first of all, I just got you down 18 million in like 60 seconds. He's like, so we're good? I'm like, no, we're not good. And that's pretty good, right? 18 million, 60 seconds. And I was like, why do you want 30 million? He's, I want a jet. I was like, yeah, I want a fucking jet too. But guess what? Like, I don't just get one. So like, we didn't have to have any more meetings and I was already in Dallas, so it was free. So like, you'd rather figure out if you're like, now you've just figured out you're in a range. So if you say, hey, I really like this. I think it's going to be in the $300 to $500, whatever. It's a $100 company. I could pay $300 to $500. They're like, yeah, it sounds good. Then you fly out and then you send them a due diligence list, which they can get online or I can give them or whatever, and start to get the free stuff, the handbook, the insurance, whatever, and see if there's any like big red flags. Then you hire the quality of earnings firm, which is like anywhere from, and we used to do a thing where it was like a $10,000 check. And if the financials looked okay, then we do a little more. And then you hire the lawyers. You already hire them, but then you get them started because the whole price process can cost $50,000 to $300,000. But you can usually figure out most of the stuff for free early. Because you don't
make a lot of sense.
I've done the other way where I did everything at once and then it blew up. And then I owed like 120 grand when I had no money. And that sucked. So now I do the Hathaway cheap version.
You know what's funny? That's exactly, we dig into the financials and the feasibility, but that's exactly how we buy real estate. There's no point. We get an LOI in place, but we've done all the computer desktop research. It works. Why would we spend any money, any time on anything until we know we can do the deal? And then of course we do our due diligence. But that's like really parallel and really good advice. Just, yeah, do it all up front or get an idea of, are we even close on price up front before you get on a plane and fly out there and fall in love with something that's going to be overpriced.
That's tough because where I come, my peer group who's in more established or bigger firms, like they have a bunch of money and they're more like CYA. So like they want to have all the boxes checked everywhere and they're sort of price agnostic. I'm more like, I just want a good deal and I'm like price sensitive. So I'm like, and I can probably, I'm a little more comfortable with just like not being quite as orthodox about like, oh, have you checked your insurance due diligence? And I'm like, yeah, I had a guy look at it and said, it's enough. They're like, what's the analysis? I'm like, that was it. You know, have you checked their DEI policy? I'm like, no, I didn't. that I don't know what it is. They have paternity leave. If they offer healthcare, yeah, we're probably good. Like, this isn't Google. Like,
I like that style, because I think if we had someone on that was talking about all these boxes that you had to check, it would just, it's unsurmountable, I think, but for me or anyone listening to this show. So that's cool to hear you say that. What about, so can we talk about what it looks like when you're like, yeah, I think I want to do this? Like, how do you wire the money and not get ripped off? What does it look like the first day when you show up and everybody's like, who's this guy?
So I think there's a few steps ahead of time. Like, when I started, I didn't have any money, and I had a guy backing me, and then he sort of, during the great financial crisis, he ran out of money. So I had to go raise money from different people. So hopefully the people listening don't have to do what I did, which is basically tell the sellers, oh, this is great. Yeah, I've got money all lined up. And then I would turn around and make a little pitch book and then go to the buyers and be like, hey, I found this great company. Like, have you done diligence? I'm like, yeah, totally. It's all checking out. And then I'd raise money over here while I'm telling these people I had the money. And so I'm basically like a shell game until like it all came together at the end. Now it's worked out financially and I've made great returns. So everyone, that's what was happening. So they give me till I'm making it. So
that is hilarious.
But I have been ripped off. My second deal ever was a horrible investment. I bought a mining services company. So they would literally go on mine sites and vulcanize rubber, where they basically take raw rubber and vulcanize it by steaming it. And it's super gnarly, or they have equipment sent in and they would service it. And I bought it from a devout woman dude who was committing fraud and forging OSHA records, using a hookers and blow sales strategy to basically generate 90% of their profit, which I should have known, because like he had like an account at like this Elko, Nevada casino, and the room I stayed in had a mirror on the ceiling and a hot tub. And there was like a lot of warning signs, but if someone's going to commit fraud or forge stuff, like, it's really hard to catch it. The legal documents usually have some recourse for that. But in this case, it was like the perfect storm of fraud, safety violations, and some other stuff that we ended up losing 2/3 of our, it saved the business, but I had to do some gnarly stuff just to keep it viable and keep our employees working for like 5 years. And then we sold it to the GM, who was a great guy. So what's it like to when you wire the money? There's always some risk. I guess I would say, so I've done whatever I said, 16, 17 deals, and I've had one super gnarly one. Every other one has had stuff that I did not expect. So like, part of that's also like, I would not pay the maximum price because I knew there was stuff in there.
Right.
You have a financial model, which is basically bullshit. It's like assumptions, which are also like, people can spend
the exact same in real
estate. Yeah, you can create all these assumptions. And then you're like, okay, but wait, if I just change this one from 6 to 9, it's like the best deal ever. If I change it from 6 to 4, it's the worst. How did you pick 6? And they're like, I did some work on them. And I'm like, wait, so you just pick 6? And I'm like, yeah. I'm like, oh, okay, that's fine. Like, just say I pick 6%. It's fine. So I think you have to have a little bit of, you have to be cool with being risk seeking. And you have to know that in general, you didn't max out. If you have $100,000 and that's all you have, don't do this. You should put like all your money in one basket and just hope, or you better be willing to dig in and go fix it if it's wrong. But there's always stuff in every company that's a little different than you expected. Like I said, I do like the free work, the cheap work, then the legal work. And most of the time you might get to visit the company once. It's like buying a house with no like inspection, there's going to be stuff.
Yeah. And even if you get an inspector, they're not going to find it all anyway.
Right. And what's happened now, like at Flint, I'm good enough. And sounds bad. And I've done this long enough that, and then Trevor, who's my partner at Flint, is one of the best operators I've ever met. So we have a playbook and we've seen enough stuff that we're like, oh, if these 5 things check out, we can figure out everything else. And it actually allows us to pay competitive or beyond competitive, because we actually know that our growth is higher than, we're the fastest growing company in the industry. We're like, oh, so growth solves a bunch of problems. But when I first started, I didn't assume any of that stuff. That's what 17 years of work will do, is that now we just feel like we have a better mousetrap, which lets us take more risk by paying more because we know that we have a good chance of making it work. When I first started, I was like, geez, I don't know. I hope this works out.
Yeah.
I hope it just doesn't go out of business. If it doesn't go out of business, I'll probably be all right.
Now, when you finance something like this, you talked earlier about private equity and you basically do leverage buyouts, which is a fancy way of saying you take a loan to buy the business. And what bank is lending you money to something that necessarily doesn't have any hard collateral, like a title to a house or a title to a building or something like that? What's that like?
Oh, no bank is lending you money. No. there'll be none. So especially it okay. So there's a few different ways you can borrow money if you want to do this. The government has a program called the SBA, Small Business Administration, SBA, where you can get these amazing loans for like 10 years or 30 years or something. I've never used it, but like, it's great. Terms are great, interest low, whatever. Just have to put your house up as collateral, which is a no-go for Colin, partly because I had no house when I started. So I didn't even have that as an option. But I do know some folks who've lost their homes. So we generally do what's called a non-recourse loan, which means like they can't come after your house. When you get to a certain size, some banks and then these private credit entities that I talked about will actually loan you money. And there's two different ways you can do it. There's an asset-based loan. So if you bought like a big manufacturing company with huge equipment that has a ton of intrinsic value, you can borrow against that equipment or you can borrow against your receivables and inventory. I've never bought companies that have all that stuff because inventory and receivables, they eat up a bunch of money. So I've never had that to loan against. So you can borrow an asset-based loan. But generally, like, I've never used that. So there's a cash flow-based loan, which is where they say, okay, the company makes $1 million a year or $2 million a year. We will loan you 2x EBITDA or 1x EBITDA. So, but for Myrtle Beach Landscaping at $350 a year, there will be no one that'll loan you money unless you're going to put up your house. So what you have to do in that situation, if you want to borrow money, is essentially you have the sellers be the bank. And so the sellers will, like, you might say, all right, I'll pay you $700,000. I'll give you $350,000. I'll give you $350,000 in cash and I'll pay you $350,000 over the next 5 years with some interest rate. And they're the bank. And like when I bought Guardian Roofing, it was too small. I probably could have pushed somebody to give me a loan, but I just said, hey, I'll give you most of the money in cash and you guys need to carry a small 20% of the purchase price as a note and I'll pay you off in 2 years. Either I'll pay it more out of my pocket or the company will. And the company usually generates enough money to pay for that.
That makes a lot of sense. We're all familiar with seller financing and real estate.
Yep.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. What about day-to-day management, right? So the owner, the original owner disappears. You step in, everybody's, okay, who's this guy? And do you look for companies that have strong day-to-day management so that it keeps running like a well-oiled machine? Or is it a red flag if the owner is the one who's doing the scheduling and stuff like that? Because as soon as they disappear, then everything, the wheels are going to fall off, right?
So it's changed a little bit. And I think I'll go back to like when I first started, because now we don't really care. We feel like we have enough resources and people, we can hire them on and I can hold it together long enough. When I first started, I did something a little bit unique. I don't know if it's unique, but like it was just different. So there's this thing, if people want to look it up, ETA, entrepreneurship through acquisition, which is a fancy way of just saying like buying a company. I don't know why you have to have an acronym, but they love it. And so like the ETA folks are all like, I want to buy a company and be the CEO. It's like buying basically a CEO job in a small business. It's great. It's been around forever. There's also these things called search funds where people raise almost like a one-time private equity fund to buy a business. ETA is sort of similar variation. In most of those cases, they're looking to take over the job from the seller. When I started, every one of my deals from 2008 to 2015, and even Guardian, I guess in 19, no 16, sorry, I bought them 16. The owners all stayed. They all kept ownership, a minority stake. And I had the Utah guy who blew, we sued him and he left. And I had one owner in Dallas who said he wanted to go. And then he saw how good things were with Sacramento and the partnership I had there. And he said, actually, I'll keep 10% and stay. And a year later, he flamed out, which was just me learning that when people say they want to leave in 90 days, it means like 15 days. When they say they want to leave in a year, it means like max 90. So I should have just listened to him when he said he wanted to go, no matter how good our partnership was in Sacramento. But so I had people there to basically who kept running it. And so I never took over as the CEO job until Flint. I was the chairman, which my wife thinks is so ridiculous. She's like, what does that even mean? I was like, no one knows. That way the owners are still like the owners. They're still in charge, even though like I'm technically the chairman or whatever, the boss. I want them to have the feeling that it's still their company. It's their business. And I don't want to be the CEO that they report to. Flint was a little different because we had a group and it was a different plan. But I don't know if cheated, but I mean, I didn't have them all walk out the door. So it was a little easier for me to get my bearings and I found the right fit. And I just haven't seen that replicated a ton, partly because that's not the design everyone has. And partly because most people, I don't know, maybe it's my background in sales or when I started, or just that I'm so exceptionally likable. But like, it's been worked out pretty well to work together. We've had really good partnerships. And then there's like a bunch of douchebags who like are like, I'm way smarter than the owner and not like, you need to get the heck out of the way. And I think what they generally find is those owners got it to where it was because they're pretty sharp. Maybe don't have a fancy degree, but I would not underestimate the intellect and operational expertise of the owners that you're taking over from. And if you do buy a business for their leaving, you just better make sure. So that's why we haven't done a commercial deal, because a lot of the smaller commercial companies, the owner knows the 100 people. That's who maintains the relationship. And so when Mrs. Jones doesn't really know who owns the plumbing company we own, but the supervisor at the big building downtown knows that his contact is the owner. Now, when the owner leaves and Timmy walks in, or Susie,
right,
or Juan, like, you better be willing to hang out with the supervisor and figure that out real fast, or figure out a way to make sure the owner stays involved long enough with a seller note or equity to help you with the transition.
That's such good advice. I think back to when I bought my first house. I was 25 years old and I took a taxi to see it for the first time because I bought it sight unseen in Las Vegas.
Sounds like a great 25, plan, by the way. Good job.
I get out of the, yeah, right? It worked out.
So night, you, right? After a night in Vegas, you're like, what did you do? I'm like, bought a house, a sight unseen.
Yeah, I flew in on a red eye. So I'm wiping sleep out of my eyes. And I show up and I look at this house and the landscapers are there and the doors are open. The moving trucks are leaving. And it was like, there was nobody to help. So I can put myself in the shoes of a pilot that like finds this landscaping company or this roofing company. And they're like, I bought it. And the owner leaves and they're like, oh my God, now. So that's great advice. I love that.
Here's Ryan, the only thing to say about the difference. So in my head, real estate's super easy because I always think it's really easy. So I'm like, oh, you just buy it and then they pay you every month and there's never any delinquencies or interest rate issues or whatever, or squatters. And then you don't have to do anything. And I'm like, I want to be in real estate because all I deal with is people all day. So I'm like, I just want to do the thing where they just pay you and you don't have to do any of this. I know that's not how it is. So I don't want to screw up everyone's goal of owning a landscaping company in Myrtle Beach. I will say for the blue collar space specifically, they are operationally intensive businesses. And if you aren't planning to be there, then you better make sure the owner's still there, or that Juan or Susie or Timmy or whoever is there, or have somebody you can stick in there, or be ready to take a 3-month sabbatical and go figure it out.
That's good stuff. And do you find that seller financing is a good way to keep the owner around? Because they're getting that monthly payment and they're like, I better make sure this business stays profitable so that these checks keep coming in.
Yeah, I think it helps. And it also helps if it's a bigger chunk, particularly for smaller businesses. There aren't like a gajillion buyers for a $300,000 landscaping company. So like you can get, I said like half down, you could get like all of it paid in seller financing. The guy might just be like, or the gal might just be like, I'm tired. I like don't want to deal with this anymore. I've got all these visas for guys to come in for the summer and I'm out. So here, just have it and pay me $100,000 a year for the next 5 years and we'll call it like good. So that's cool. Yeah. But he may also just be like, I'm literally moving to Wyoming and I don't give a shit. And so you want to try and suss that part out. Will they actually help? Does $500,000 for a guy worth $5 million matter?
Right.
You know?
Such good advice.
Yeah.
This is fun.
So we've talked through like how to find the business in today's world.
Getting all like hot and bothered by this call. Like remembering all this trauma. I'm like, oh God. I'll be like in a tank top and jorts here in a few minutes.
Don't cut this out.
Yeah, this is great. This makes it a little bit more natural.
It's all natural.
You know, some of the things we've talked about in previous shows have been, you know, by the way, a lot of really good episodes on Colin. If you want to learn more, we can put that in the show notes. But you said that one of the things that you look at is like treating people how you would expect to be treated. And that's one of the first couple of things that you do when you take over a business. You help with, hey, what's the health insurance and what is PTO like? And I remember you recalled the story. You took over a company where holidays, you actually had to take PTO to take a holiday. Yep. And how ridiculous that was, that your controller or CPA or whatever was requesting time off for Labor Day or something. Yep. Can you talk to that kind of culture and how you add that seasoning onto a business that might really make the difference between it being successful or not?
This goes back to that whole thing of get on Teams or Zoom with them first, see how it goes and see if you connect. because there's going to be people that you just, now you may love their business, but like if they're someone you just can't really relate to, I think it's harder because it's just going to get worse. The transactions are stressful. When they leave, they're less inclined to help you, whatever. And then I also just think like, I ask a ton of questions about how the business operates, how they think about things, their family, all this stuff you're not allowed to ask in regular HR questions. Nothing crazy, but I just want to understand like the makeup of how they think about things. Because generally these companies have been around a long time and the owners have impacted the culture immensely, right? With how they treat the people and what the expectations are. And if they're taking shortcuts as an owner or kind of like poo-pooing customer service, there's a good chance that's exactly how everyone else at the company treats them, because no one usually cares more than the owner. So like I try and figure that out ahead of time. And there are some operational things that I think we can identify where we're like, oh, we can probably do that better. I mean, simple, our 401k plan is better than a lot of people's, whatever, you know, some of that stuff. But if like the basic intentions of the owner and how they run the business don't align with my value system, then I just assume it's probably not going to work, because it's really hard to change the culture of a business. And that example of taking time off for Labor Day, that wasn't a big deal, but like in that same company, they used to train all the managers on taking people to small claims court for $400 to $1,200. Meanwhile, there was like all these other things in the business that would have more than paid for that if we just would have done it better. And like our reputation with the customer base was not that great. So like it's worth $400 to $600 just to make sure the customer's happy. Trevor, my partner, who's amazing at this, says, dude, you just want them to be happy, use you again, right, and not talk badly about you. You take someone to a small claims court, they tell everyone, you know? And so I think for me, I always start from, it needs to be like 80% or more, like sort of aligned with how I'd want it. And maybe they're just missing some things, but if it's, had I known this stuff about Utah and how they treated things, like I never would have done it. Wouldn't have mattered if it made a gajillion dollars, because right after I bought it, made $0, you know?
You've got a good knack for interviewing. You can pull really good information out of people. Can you speak to some of the things, books you've read or strategies or things that have helped you become a really good interviewer? Because I think that's one thing I admire about, we do interviews together, by the way, we have once or twice, and it seems like you've got a really good approach to pulling out really good information from people that make it matter. And I think that's what you're talking about. Your team's messaging or Zooming this person and you're asking them really good questions to get really good intel out of them.
Yeah, I guess I think I'm pretty good at the first impression, but I, like, there's just a few things. So like one, if you ever have a meeting with someone, you should have an agenda. Like you should have an agenda. So if you want to go to Biz Buy Sell and you find a company and they send you some stuff, don't just call them. Have an agenda, right? I go through all the stuff and I write up all the questions. They're not like mind blowing. It's like marketing. How do you do it? What percent do you spend on digital versus this? What's your healthcare? Like and even if you don't get them right, this is like me practicing for years to get the list right so I can create it in 3 minutes. But like, you have an agenda. That's one. Two, don't take yourself too seriously. Well, I'm thinking back to like when I first started, like you want to have confidence, but like be approachable, normal. That's a guy who used to sit behind me at my old firm. Every call he mentioned, he went to Stanford twice and he worked in Prague and all this shit. And I'm like, dude, you know who gives no shits about that? The landscaping guy. In fact, he's going to think like you're either kind of a douchebag or he's not going to want to talk to you, or he'll be intimidated and not want to talk to you. So what are you doing? And guess what? Like, he didn't buy any companies because he was kind of unapproachable and unlikable. So hopefully he doesn't listen to this. Those are the first two. And then there's a really good book. It's not so much on interviewing like this where we talk to a business owner, but there's a book called Who by a guy named Jeff Smart that I follow religiously when interviewing for everything, basically above a plumber. Plumbers, technicians have like experience. You got to figure out if they have the expertise to do it. But any type of like customer service job, accounting job, supervisor, manager, whatever, I follow this book. I read it and I created Cliff Notes. And then basically I just follow it. And the screening interview alone has saved me like gajillions of hours, because you can do it in 20 to 40 minutes. You ask the same five questions, whether it's the CEO or the customer service rep. And I can pretty much flush out people. And if it's only 40 minutes, you just schedule 3 hours and there's 2 hours, you can get three done. So just knock them out. And then you go to the more advanced one where for customer service rep, it might be 45 minutes to an hour. For a CEO, it's 2 hours. And you follow these same questions and you just follow the book and just do it. And the amount of stuff I've flushed out from that in hiring people it hasn't guaranteed they're a great hire. It has flushed out some sketchy dudes and gals who are just lying.
Colin, thank you for your time. Yeah. I know that we're at the top of the hour here. This has been really helpful. Let's end it with just a crazy story. Experience in the roofing company, craziest rescue missions your team has pulled off on a job site. What are some of the day-to-day fun stories that you would be willing to share, or a story?
Hookers and blow one's hard to beat with a hot tub of mirrors.
I was going to say that one's hard to beat.
Yeah, that's like that's my true. Best.
Yeah.
No, I just think, I guess, like, I don't have a crazy story. I was like thinking about, oh yeah, like we dig trenches and people can't believe how expensive we are in sewer jobs. And it turns out like this business owner, his helper died last year because they dug a trench and it collapsed. It turns out like not in our company, but we lost a job to a company that was cheaper and two guys died on the job site. Unfortunately, I mean, I'm in companies that have a lot of employees. And so when you have a lot of employees, like stuff happens. I mean, like guys get electrocuted, not on our job site, but just other stuff. People have had some gnarly things. I guess the thing I'd say, this is not going to be all this panache, but I love what I do. I love it. I love that what we get to do is we have these cool companies that are not like super sexy and they help people daily. And they're not always that happy that we are helping them. Think about if your toilet blew up or your roof's leaking, you're not that excited, but we get to help people. And then basically we get to improve the lives of our employees because we have quite a bit of work. We pay really well. We give them opportunities to grow as we grow. And it's like, we're like the micro version of like the American dream in some ways. Right. And I like it because I can understand it. I don't really understand the AI and I don't understand some of the tech stuff and I might think it's bullshit. For us, we just get to do good work every day. And if we do really good, our employees are better off, the customers are better off, and we do just fine. And it's pretty simple. It's really hard, but it's pretty simple. And I love it. I feel so fortunate and lucky. And for people who are thinking about doing this or doing something like this, like it's really hard to own a small business. It's so rewarding. It's scary. It's fun. It's a lot of work, but it's super rewarding.
I love it.
That's great. That's
if you've ever owned a business, you definitely know exactly what you're talking about.
Yep.
The best and the hardest thing you ever do.
Yep.
So
can relate to that.
Thanks, Colin, for coming on.
Yeah, and thanks for having me. So nice to talk to you guys.
Yeah. Sharing your wisdom. And
when 100 pilots buy roofing companies, then we can go back on and have a big session.
That's it.
Do a little counseling.
Exactly. That sounds good. You can start your consulting firm.
Are there any things you'd like to leave the audience? I don't know if you want to give any way for people to follow you or contact you or resources that you might recommend. Probably not, right?
Well, you can follow. I'm not on social media because I have like undiagnosed ADHD and like I had to get off Facebook in about 90 seconds because I couldn't be on any of those things. And I got on Twitter for 2 weeks and got so angry at all these people. It was like an idiot echo chamber. And I was like, I can't be on this anymore. So yeah, I'm on Twitter. You can follow me there. I won't ever check it. LinkedIn is good. Or if you need anything, I'll leave it up to you to figure out how to get a hold of me.
Perfect. I love it.
It's not that hard.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom, Colin.
Yeah, my pleasure. It was really fun. Thank you guys for having me.
All right, everybody, till the next show. Talk to you later.